little bit of time. If there's anything you want to raise as a question, or anything didn't feel clear, anything you want to reflect on, we'll have a little bit of time for that. Yes, please.
Yeah, this is mainly the board side, but a week ago is a remembrance for primarily for World War One, and I've been confused as to what to think and feel about that. On a personal level, I suppose a couple of great uncles that their bodies are somewhere more than France on one side, on the other side there's 10 million soldiers lost their lives, and then another 10 million civilians, and there's all the repercussions that flowed on from this extraordinary kind of, what's a good word, slaughter, or insanity, whatever it is. So it's, you know, in this context, you know, what do you do with all that? Because as the generations march along, it won't sit in living memory at all. It'll become a story and something that people study, and this follows that, follows that. So it's just something I suppose a lot of people will have been thinking about over the last
The question is, what do you do with that? None of us are ever going to annihilate our past. And our past go back to places that we don't even know. You know, we have to think of our kind of generational inheritances. And what have we learned? You know, and I think in a way, you know, reflection upon, you know, I love that saying, you know, that if you want to know about your past, look at your mind now. And if you want to know about your future, look at your mind now. And I think that speaks to that question. I think every philosopher will say, you know, if we don't learn from the past, we repeat it. This is true, I think, on a collective level, and it's true on a personal level. You know, and I think remembrances, you know, interesting, one of the definitions of sati, mindfulness, is to remember. It is to remember. It's cultivating a quality of remembering which is not about dwelling upon the past, it's not about sort of obsessing about the past, but it is about learning, and it's about remembering what we value, remembering what is important, you know, and remembering the capacity to change the shape of our minds and hearts. And I think of it not like in the context of wars, but I think about how many people are, you know, the heirs of generational patterns. You know, I think everyone in social work knows this, everyone in psychology knows this. How many people are the heirs of generational patterns, whether they're generational patterns of impatience or lack of self-worth or generational patterns of rage or generational patterns of greed? And actually, you really think about where do we change the tide of patterns, whether they are collective, whether they are family, or whether they are personal. Where do we change the tide of patterns? And it can, you know, my sense, it can only be through changing the shape of our own hearts and minds. And so remembering, you know, is part of sati, and is part of that process of change. It's not about, you know, the opposite of sati is forgetting. The opposite of sati is forgetting. But remembering is different than dwelling.
I'm just wondering if you could help me work through something in my mind. I was in terms of connecting the sense of self, the conceited nature of self, because I was in sort of a situation a couple of weeks ago that I realised went from compassion to pity. And I know you were saying that you can go from sense of self, personality, view. But it was, if I tell you what it was sort of someone who wanted to go on a date with me, and I didn't really want to because I had before and I felt it wasn't right for me, but kind of he pushed and pushed, and out of pity I kind of did. I know.
I know. And a grand evening was had by all.
Yeah, was sort of there at the time pushing, and so it just kind of, I thought we were meeting up as friends, and I can't work out in my head exactly how I got to that, and so without knowing how I got to that, I can't work out exactly how to not do that again. And
I wonder if it's pity or if, you know, one of the manifestations of inferiority conceit is a sense of obligation. That I'm so afraid of hurting somebody or hurting somebody's feelings that I may do or say things that people want me to do, to live as a reflex of other people's expectations, because this is a very subtle part of inferiority conceit.
Yeah, I didn't want to hurt him.
Because you don't want to hurt someone, and so I feel obliged. I feel obliged in some way, or responsible even, to take care of somebody else's expectations or needs or insistence or whatever, because I feel somehow that inferiority conceit drowns our voice.
Okay.
It drowns our capacity to actually say what is actually needed and what is actually truthful for us in that moment.
Because I said it and he decided to ignore that. So I think it was like, yeah, but that's really helpful. Thank you. Got to be stronger. Stick to my guns.
I was really interested in your experience in the post office with the heart sink girl. And I wondered if you would ever use an experience like that or be in an experience like that and see it as an opportunity to invite somebody to do something else, like give them some reading or say a bit about your background or say it doesn't have to be like that.
In the post office.
Yes, in the post office.
What I did say in that moment, I said, you know, this time you're not the person somebody always pushes in front of in the line. Mm. Mm. No, I tend not to go around with my bag full of literature. There's a question of appropriateness, and there's a question of when someone invites or is interested. My birth family has no idea what I do. I am 62 years old, and my parents are still alive, and I have brothers and a brother and a sister, and they have no idea what I do because they have never actually asked. And even though I see the enormous, I know that sounds absurd, they got it vaguely. You know, but they, my mother says I teach people to hum. And my brother says that my endless traveling to teach is in a drunken moment, said it must be a disguise for drug running. Okay, so someone, no, but they never actually ask, you know, and, you know, I've given them books that I've written, you know, and they're still in the cellophane wrapper, but they're on the bookshelf, you know, but I am a kind of a really firmly feel that, you know, the Dharma, you know, the Buddha always said, ehi pasuko, come and listen, you know, see for yourself. And I've always felt this sense of, you know, that open-hearted welcome of the Dharma. I mean, my family loves that I practice. They love that I turn up to do the caring in crisis moments. You know, they love that I'm the person who's equanimous in the midst of somebody having a triple heart bypass. You know, they love that I'm there patiently doing their rehab when they're going through. They love that I practice. But they think it's kind of weird. So they never ask how this one person in their family ended up quite different than anybody else in the family. You know, I'm a sort of alien import. So I don't feel any. I don't feel. You know, I feel like someone. It's an open door. You know, I've certainly laid enough breadcrumbs on the trail. But they don't ask.
What I'm wondering, because I my sense of vocation is, you know, I need to bring it down, but what I'm wondering is, might that be a quest the fact that that person said something that might have been a little step out of their life, and there might have been something about you.
Oh, who knows? Who knows? And in that moment, perhaps they also received the response they were looking for.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
I'm hoping.
Okay.
You know, because I didn't hear that and say, "Oh, good, I can." I'm so grateful for your inferiority. It's going to save me 2 minutes today. You know? So maybe, hopefully, you know, who knows how those seeds get planted?
Yeah.
Really, you know.
Sorry, can I just check something quite practical?
Yes, please.
You're saying that, you know, sometimes you'll notice a moment of selfing or a thought pattern or... and I think what you were saying was it's important to just kind of notice it. And then it's about maybe applying patience, equanimity, those kind of things, perhaps to oneself in terms of that those stories. Would that be?
Well, you know, I mean, I think.
Or is it more just
the first piece is the knowing.
Mm.
That's such a crucial piece. The first piece is always the knowing of developing that kind of literacy about our own processes. You know, and the literacy about what gets us into trouble, what causes struggle, and much brings it to an end. And so that knowing is such a crucial piece. And you know, maybe it seems obvious, but a lot of time we can be wandering around, getting spit out the end of some storm of agitation, saying, what was that all about? So developing the knowing is really crucial. That's an indispensable first step. But, you know, I think the Buddha was really realistic in really acknowledging, you know, some of the intractable nature of some of the most deeply embedded patterns we have. And selfing is one of them. You know, and the Buddha never prescribed a one-dimensional approach. You know, his approach was really multidimensional. And, you know, there's one text where the Buddha goes through this quite lengthy list of responses to the intractable, the most stubborn of all patterns. And of course, the list begins with mindfulness. It begins with that knowing, you know, that kind of literacy. But then, you know, every time in this discourse it goes on, and then the Buddha say, and if it still arises, you know, then he would suggest, you know, cultivate what's missing. Okay, so what's the energetic nature of selfing? It's contractedness, isn't it? It's impulsiveness. Cultivate what's missing. Spaciousness. What is calm in the body in this moment? What is calm even in this moment? He said, if it still arises, take your attention elsewhere. Because sometimes even the quality of attention we're giving is colored already by the identification. Take your attention elsewhere, what's not implicated in this selfie moment. He said, cultivate what's happened, you know, helpful. Cultivate the compassion, cultivate the kindness, cultivate the generosity. He says, investigate. What is the felt sense of this? You know, what is the felt sense of selfing? How do I know it in the body? How do I know it in the mind? How do I know it in the thought patterns? You know, he says, and if it still arises, you know, I'm probably missing out a few here. He says, you know, press your tongue against your roof of your mouth and don't go there. Because sometimes we see the habitual nature of it and the habitual nature of feeding. That contractedness is so strong that, you know, we sometimes think that restraint has got nothing to do with this practice. It does, you know. And sometimes it's a commitment, isn't it? And of not engaging in something, not volunteering for suffering. He says sometimes recognize, he says if it still arises, recognize, you know, what you're wanting from this habit. You know, what's the kind of hidden outcome you think might come? You know, because have you noticed sometimes, you know, like there's no more insight? Have you noticed sometimes around patterns like there's no more insight? Like I've been around the pattern of aversion or you know, jealousy or impatience 5 million times now. I understand exactly where it came from. You know, I know everything there is to know about it, and now it's a habit. Mm-hmm. And the well is dry. You know, there's no more insight to come. And that's when the tongue against the roof of the mouth helps. And he says, if it still arises, ask for help. Ask for help. You know, that's somewhere that we're not always seeing so clearly for ourselves. So you know, really have, you know, I think have the confidence that it's a kind of not a one-dimensional responsiveness. You know, I often think of this path and this teaching as kind of like a symphony, you know, and every instrument is contributing to the whole. And sometimes, you know, we need to give more attention space to one instrument rather than another.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes, the last one. Yeah.
Just to reflect a bit further on the lady's question, who was went on a date, because you talked about the self-conceit of inferiority, self-conceit, but sometimes it seems to me that it's very difficult sometimes then to see or negotiate the dividing line between that, what you're talking about, and compassion, because it seems to me that our friend's impulse was actually initially compassionate and kind. So just to use my own example, yesterday I spent the whole day with a friend, and I had to, and she was very, very needy, and she has very little space for somebody listening to her. You know, she's got three small kids, etc. Hardly ever has a day off. And I would have liked to have a little bit of space to talk to her about what was going on for me. But in the end, I just had to let go of any thought of that, because I wanted to be able to give her the space to talk, to cry, and do whatever she needed to do. And I just had to let go of anything for myself. Now, at the end of the day, I was drained and tired, and I was feeling emotional. She went home. And, you know, I thought I transgressed all of my own boundaries for what I actually needed in that situation. I needed a bit less of it. But the impulse, I didn't think, I mean, just listening to you now, I'd like to work out then what was going on. Because there wasn't really a point, even in retrospect, because I suffered, but, you know, I'll survive. And it was because I feel, out of compassion, I really wanted to listen and give her a space out of compassion. But now I'm questioning it because of what you said about inferiority.
No, it's true. It's a good question. It's a good reflection, because I understand how thin the line can be. I mean, yes, it's true. Your first impulse, not wanting to hurt somebody's feelings, can be a totally compassionate, kind impulse. It can also be a habit pattern. Okay, so herein maybe lies the difference. Yeah. That I repeatedly place myself in that position where I'm unable to voice everything, you know, not only the unable to voice that actually this is enough, or this is a boundary, that I repeatedly yield that boundary because I feel like I can't hurt someone, because if I hurt someone, they might reject me. Okay. So it is a complex territory. You know, it's a complex territory. And we should never, of course, be in a position of denying that first response of compassion. Of course I want to help. But is it a habit pattern that I actually am always the helper? I'm always the one who puts myself in that position out of the anxiety of what might happen if I don't. Okay, that's different than compassion. That's different than compassion. And that, you know, that's a discernment inwardly, isn't it? That's a discernment inwardly. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I see, you know, it's not so uncommon, is it, that people can be remarkably, for example, generous towards another and ungenerous towards themselves. Remarkably compassionate towards another, very harsh inwardly. Remarkably kind towards another, very unkind inwardly. This, I think, is rooted in inferiority conceit, that somehow I am not deserving of either having the voice, or I'm not deserving of being able to say, you know, this is also...
I hear what you're saying, yes, and I agree with you, but where is the compassion in that? Because that, even if that is rooted in inferiority conceit, and you're much better at being compassionate, loving, kind, friendly, warm, appreciative towards other people and not to yourself, does that actually negate...
No, it doesn't negate that intention.
Does it mean that that's not...
No, it doesn't negate that intention at all. It doesn't negate that that unhesitating reaching out, which is the compassion.
That if it's only going one way, it is self-consciousness.
Well, no, it's compassion, and it's compassion that has this underlying background of you know, where inferiority conceit may be a default mechanism. But it doesn't deny the value or the authenticity of that reaching out. You know, and I think it's really important not to doubt that, you know, or not to feel, oh, you know, maybe that's not really compassion. That unhesitating gesture to care is compassion. If it is repetitive and only ever in one direction, there may be something else going on in parallel. Yeah. Because either they can coexist.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, I want to thank you for your attention today. And just before we end, we have a couple of